Hello and welcome to the Science Podcast for January 18th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, genetic testing for psychiatric disorders, a possible viral culprit in a rare skin cancer, the legacy of water-powered mills, and introducing the Science Signaling Podcast. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Genetic testing for psychiatric disorders is controversial for two reasons. First of all, there's no scientific consensus that there are genes that confer an increased risk for psychiatric disorders. Second, such genetic testing raises ethical questions. For instance, suppose you were told you had an increased risk for bipolar disorder. How would you respond? Would you have children? What if your employer found out? In this week's Science, news writer Jennifer Cousin reports on a company that now offers a genetic test for bipolar disorder.
This story is about genetic testing in psychiatric illnesses, looking particularly at a test that recently went on the market for bipolar disorder and that is aiming to test whether someone is likely to be diagnosed with the disease, whether they're at a higher risk, and if they have symptoms but there's difficulty diagnosing them, do they in fact have bipolar? And can these genes help us answer that question?
Are there in fact verified genes that actually confer risk for bipolar disorder and other psychiatric disorders?
Well, it really depends on whom you ask when it comes to bipolar in particular. There are some genes that have been identified for a number of different psychiatric illnesses. The question is whether those genes will really stand the test of time. And in bipolar disorder, some scientists think, yes, we have found, you know, four or five genes that really are fairly solid. And there are other scientists who, quite prominent scientists, who said to me, look, we haven't found any genes yet for bipolar disorder that we can really count on.
So are these scientists, these prominent scientists who say that they haven't found it, are they against this kind of information, this kind of gene testing coming to market?
I think that they have concerns about it happening now. I think they certainly feel that in general it can help people. But some scientists are very cautious, and they worry that we don't have solid enough information to start marketing these tests. On the other hand, the company and the individuals that I profiled in the story say, look, scientists might think that way, but bipolar disorder is really tough to diagnose. It takes many years, and people suffer a lot in that time and may be given misdiagnoses and bad information. And any little bit can help, and it makes sense to be offering doctors and patients this information.
Well, to that, will doctors be able to really understand the results of these genetic tests, much less perhaps the patients who aren't medically trained?
I think that's a really good question, and we just don't know the answer to that yet because the tests haven't been available for a long enough time. But that's certainly a concern that some people have. I think that the companies that are in this area are aware that this is a challenge, and they do want to provide doctors with, you know, some good information about how to interpret the test. But most doctors, whether they're psychiatrists or general practitioners, may not know a whole lot about genetic testing. And like you say, the clients, the patients often don't either. So it could be a challenge to interpret. And I think what's especially difficult here is this is really a different kind of genetic information than we've had in the past. Here, having a certain version of a gene doesn't mean that you're going to get the disease. It just means that you might be at a higher risk for the disease, which could mean your risk goes from 1% to 2%. It doesn't mean it's going up to 90%. And how do we even think about that information? What do we do with it? That's a question that people are asking. But the companies that are in this area and the scientists that are working with these companies, for them, the business model is let's try to do one better than medicine today and, you know, offer doctors a little more than they have right now.
Well, given the kind of inevitability, it seems, of these tests and reaching the market, will there be protections in place to limit the misuse of this information?
I think the companies are really doing their best to protect confidentiality. But one of the biggest ways to prevent discrimination is what's called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, known as GINA, which has lingered in Congress for quite a while and has never become law. And if that does pass and is signed into law, that will hopefully protect against discrimination by employers or insurance companies based on genetic information. So certainly these companies are keen to see that pass.
Okay, well, how much will these tests cost? And beyond the company, who benefits financially?
Well, the company that I profiled in this story is named Cynomics, which has a test that is available now for bipolar disorder, charges $750 for people to be tested both for a couple different variants on one gene that the company believes can help guide diagnosis and also for another gene that may indicate someone's response to certain medication. And we don't know that much about the cost of other tests since they're not on the market yet, but they're, you know, certainly in the hundreds of dollars, if not higher. And who benefits financially? Well, in addition to the companies benefiting financially, there are other parties here that will get some payback for sale of these tests and development of these tests. And those are the patent holders, those who patented the discoveries. Most of these discoveries were made at universities, patented by the schools. So the universities, as with any discovery that is commercialized, you know, will take a cut, as well as the scientist at the university who made the discovery and also will get a share of the licensing fees.
It sounds like there are a lot of scientists who are really willing to stake their reputation on bringing these tests to market.
Yeah, I think there are a few scientists, often, you know, very well respected and have made some discoveries that they feel strongly about and also believe very strongly that this information can help people and that it should be available. But there are certainly a number of other scientists who really disagree and are concerned about this happening, and physicians as well. You know, what I heard is that a lot of this may be driven by patients and families who really are keen to get some of this information. For example, the bipolar test that I covered is set up so that anyone can order the test, including a family member who has symptoms but has not been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. But the information, that the DNA results, go to a physician so that the physician can help interpret and the results and counsel that individual.
Jennifer Cousin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science News writer Jennifer Cousin reports on genetic testing for psychiatric disorders. Read her article in this week's Science. Scientists have discovered a new virus that appears to be the culprit in a rare but deadly form of skin cancer called Merkel cell carcinoma. In a paper published online this week by Science, Patrick Moore and colleagues describe how they made their discovery using a new technique called digital transcriptome subtraction, a technique that could be used to identify viruses lurking as potential causes of other cancers. I spoke with Moore from his office at the University of Pittsburgh.
We've found a new virus, a polyomavirus, in Merkel cell carcinoma, and we find it integrated into the genome of Merkel cell carcinoma, and it's integrated in such a way that it looks as if the virus was present before the tumor actually started growing. It's in a what we call a somatically integrated monoclonal pattern. And so this suggests that the virus was present before the tumor took off, and so that at least gives us some evidence that the virus may play a role in this tumor.
What exactly is Merkel cell carcinoma, and what about it, other than it being present in advance, suggests that the carcinoma may have been caused by this virus?
Merkel cell carcinoma is a cancer of the Merkel cells of the skin. These are mechanoreceptor cells that are responsible for feeling touch and pressure. And they're actually a type of cell that's derived from the neural crest. They're neuroendocrine tumors, meaning they have features of both the nervous system and the endocrine system. The tumor itself is very interesting because, first of all, it's unfortunately a very severe tumor. It's the most aggressive skin cancer, and it frequently causes death within 6 to 9 months in about 50% of patients that have advanced disease. Also, the other interesting thing about this cancer is that it occurs more frequently in immunosuppressed patients, so people who have AIDS or transplant patients or people who are immunosuppressed from chemotherapy. And because it's an immune-related tumor, we thought, well, there's a good possibility that there might be a directly transforming tumor virus in this tumor, and then we could search for it by sequencing its transcriptome, sequencing the RNA from the tumor, and using a new technique that we've developed called digital transcriptome subtraction, be able to find all of the RNA sequences that are common to the human genome and subtract those away. And what we're left with is a relatively small pool of sequences that could be candidate sequences from a virus. And so then we analyzed those sequences and we found that one of them is similar to but distinct from all known polyomaviruses, suggesting that it is a new human polyomavirus.
That sounds like a very difficult process to undertake. What makes it so difficult to find a virus for cancer?
Well, there are two things. One is that if you look at the size of this virus, the viral genome is only 1/800,000th the size of the human genome. So if you're going to use any technique to try and find it, you've got to somehow try to enrich or at least isolate the viral sequences. But secondly, tumors are associated with either latency or a pseudo-latency for viruses, which means that the virus actually doesn't form capsids generally in most tumors. And so it's difficult to physically isolate away the virus in some way from a tumor. Instead, we just have viral DNA either in this case inserted into the tumor genome or as an episome separate from the human genome.
So this would mean then that this particular sequence or these sequences might even be found in normal skin cells?
No. So this is a virus, and we don't think that it is a universal infection of humans. We think it is probably a common infection, meaning that perhaps something between 5 and 20% of people may harbor this infection. And only some cells are going to be infected and are going to be harboring this virus. And it turns out that the virus itself, virus, of course, is made of DNA, and it can undergo mutations. And when it undergoes a mutation that causes it to integrate into the Merkel cell genome, it then predisposes that cell to becoming a cancer cell. So only very few people who are actually infected with this virus develop this cancer.
So is this the cause of Merkel cell carcinoma?
We have not proven that this virus causes Merkel cell carcinoma. I don't think that it's fair to say that. All we can say at this point in time is that this virus is very strongly associated with Merkel cell carcinoma. So it will take a lot of investigations and a lot of work in a lot of different ways to confirm and to extend these findings. So I think it would be very premature to say that this is the cause of Merkel cell carcinoma. But it is an interesting new finding.
Okay. Well, then to this new technique, this digital transcriptome subtraction, could you describe a little bit more about how that works?
Okay, so digital transcriptome subtraction, or DTS, let's call it that. DTS is stupefyingly simple to describe because all we do is simply sequence all of the RNA in a tumor. How we do that is we isolate the RNA first, and we turn it into cDNA, which is a DNA copy of the RNA, and then we sequence it. And the technology is developed to the point now where high-throughput sequencing can now easily sequence hundreds of thousands of pieces of cDNA at a relatively low cost. And that's the level of sequencing that we need to achieve in order to directly sequence a viral RNA that might be in a tumor.
And then you compare it to the human genome in some way to see how the virus DNA or cDNA is different?
That's exactly right. And so in this case, we sequenced 400,000 sequences from four tumors. And then what we did was we took all of those sequences and we compared them to the deposited human genome and we subtracted them all out. And once we subtracted them all out, we were left with 2,500 sequences that did not exactly match human genome. Many of those sequences are errors in sequencing and so forth. But so what that means is that 99.4% of the sequences did match to the human genome, but there are so many sequences that we're still left with this huge list of sequences that we have to evaluate. And then we took those 2,500 sequences and we now aligned them to all of the virus sequences to see if there is something that was similar that had already been sequenced. We found that one transcript did align to polyomaviruses. It was similar to known polyomaviruses, but sufficiently different that made us suspect that we'd found a new human polyomavirus. And so this will be the fifth human polyomavirus.
Will your team and other researchers be able to apply this same technique to try and find viruses that may be lurking as potentially involved in other cancers?
Yeah, we hope to apply this to other. There are a number of tumors that physicians have long suspected might have a viral infection. So we would like to be able to apply this technique to those tumors. and be able to identify new agents. And I think that it's quite possible to do that. Now, there's an important caveat that I'd like to mention about DTS, and that is that it's quantitative. And what that means is that we directly sequence all of the RNA in a tumor sample. So if only, say, 1/10 of the tumor sample is actually composed of cells that are infected with the virus, then we have to sequence 10 times as much in order to achieve a level of sequencing that would allow us to find the virus. So this technique will not work for all diseases. Autoimmune disorders, for example, would be a set of diseases where we would like to find a viral trigger, but in that case, we suspect that the viral genome will not be plentiful enough for us to be able to actually find it. But it's been a long, hard road to develop DTS. It's been a group effort, and I'd like to mention the lead author on this, Wei-Chen Feng, has been instrumental in pushing this to the point where we can actually use it to find new viruses. And we finally succeeded in finding one after 8 years of developing this technique. And now that we have this technique, I think that it actually has a lot of applicability to other human diseases that might be caused by a cryptic viral infection.
Patrick Moore, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Patrick Moore is senior author of a paper on a new virus that may be behind a rare form of skin cancer and the technique his team used to find it. You can read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. New research suggests that many of the streams and rivers in the eastern United States were not originally single ribbon-like channels. Instead, early settlers found many smaller channels and wetlands and dammed them up. That transformed the landscape, made it more subject to flooding, and reduced the enormous carbon sink such wetlands provided. In a paper in this week's Science, Robert Walter and Dorothy Meritz present their research and suggest implications not only for the stream restoration industry in the U.S., but in Europe, too, where mid to late medieval damming may have had similar impacts in Britain and across much of northern Europe. I spoke with Walter and Meritz from their offices at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
We now know from our work that within about two generations of European settlement in the mid-Atlantic of the United States, that the streams were altered from whatever they were to a series of linked slack water ponds that were created by intensive milling and mill damming for water-powered milling operations. Just about every mechanical purpose that you could conceive of in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century was done by water-powered milling operations. And what we've found out is that all this damming of these stream valleys from basically head to mouth of the streams created an unusual situation where the streams were changed by not just the slack water deposits themselves or the slack water itself, but by the sediments that came off the landscape. Because at the same time that they were building these mills and mill dams, they were clearing the upland slopes for agriculture. And this increased the sediment erosion rate enormously and brought tremendous amounts of soil down into the valley bottoms where the soil was sequestered in these mill pond reservoirs.
We refer to this transformation as the Great Sediment Experiment, albeit an unwitting experiment. We're now generating extremely high sediment yields of many hundreds of tons of sediment per square kilometer of drainage area, but it's not because of poor farming practices on the uplands. It's quite the contrast. We have modern best management practices that are actually quite effective in most places. Instead, what we have is deep incised channels into old reservoir-filled ponds that we've all forgotten about, and we've had over-steepened streams that are so deep that they're able to actually carve deep down below the original landscape into this ancient gravel, which hadn't moved in over 10,000 years. And so it's carrying that gravel, carrying all that silt and clay. The silt and clay can go a long ways, generally down to the Chesapeake Bay, the Delaware Bay, etc. So it is truly a remarkable but inadvertent experiment.
So does this research have implications for streams outside of the eastern United States?
Yes, it does, because the milling technology was quite ancient. The millers who arrived here in the eastern United States in the 1600s and then the 1700s and 1800s, they were actually being brought over from England and France and Germany. They were highly specialized, much like modern engineers in many ways. When they got here, they knew how to identify the best mill seats and where to put in the best dams and so forth. Well, that technology came from this long history of the same processes going on in Europe. And so in France, by the year 1700 AD, the historians think that there were close to 80,000 mills. And historic maps of England show mill densities that are very similar to the mill densities that we get here. And the maps for England and France look much like our maps for Lancaster, York, and Chester counties here in Pennsylvania. So the mill density is not coincidence, a similarity in mill density. The reason the mill densities are so close to one another in England and here, historic mill densities in England and here in Pennsylvania and Maryland, is that the millers knew that if they built a mill dam of about 2 to 3 meters in height, which was typical for a Piedmont relief landscape, that they would have to go about 3 kilometers upstream in order to put the next dam in. So that was a given based on the gradient of the stream valley bottoms and the relief of the landscape and the height that they needed for the head to run their water-powered mills. So that it does have implications for why the streams of England and France look the way they do, which is much the way the streams here look.
Now, the way that these streams used to be...
The pre-settlement condition in these valley bottoms, it's simply this hydric wetland soil that goes from side to side of the valley. Dark, organic-rich wetland soils that we call hydric soils. We've yet to see in any of our stratigraphic sections, in any of the coring, any of the trenching that we've done, a river channel, a stream channel down in the pre-settlement deposits. And this is telling us something very interesting about what we think the streams look like, that they were basically a broad vegetated wetlands rather than our current notion that these are single channel streams with high banks. That didn't exist 300 years ago when the early settlers arrived. What the streams looked like were broad, flat, vegetated wetlands, maybe with some trees and islands and so forth, maybe lots of beaver. And I think the important point here is that for at least the Holocene, the 10,000-year record that we have indicated to us in this hydric soil from all the radiocarbon dates that we have, that there was very little sediment, inorganic sediment, coming off the landscape in pre-settlement time, mainly because the uplands were highly vegetated, they were highly forested. So there was very little soil erosion, so there was very little sediment being transported, but there was a lot of organic material that was being buried and sequestered in these valley bottoms in these anoxic conditions, reducing conditions within this frequently inundated, water-saturated, hydric soil environment.
That suggests that it would have been a major carbon sink, wouldn't it have been?
Yeah, our calculations, we've made some calculations based on the total carbon content. We get concentrations of carbon down there that are on the order of about 250 to over 1,000 tons of carbon per hectare that's stored in these valley bottoms. So these are tremendous carbon sinks down there. And the big issue is that now the streams are incising down through the post-settlement alluvial stack, the mill pond sediments, if you will, and are eroding out this hydric soil, and they're transporting what was once stored and sink. It's being transported downstream and potentially releasing that carbon by oxidation. CO2 could be a CO2 source, if you will, rather than a CO2 sink.
So what exactly then comes next in terms of restoration projects?
So the problem with restoration at the moment is that we haven't characterized the cause of channel instability correctly and fully, and we've more likely, and by we I mean all of the people looking at the problem, we've been more likely to blame modern current land use practices than an ancient legacy effect and also base level change associated with dam breaching.
There's another point that we should bring out is that we've been calling these valley flat surfaces for decades now. We've been calling them floodplains, and so very little infrastructure is built on these surfaces because they are floodplains. So it's more of an issue of convincing people that this is the best thing to do, not just for the environment, but for lots of other reasons, to try to remove as much of this sediment as possible and get back to the original wetland condition.
Dorothy Meritz and Robert Walter, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
Dorothy Meritz and Robert Walter co-author a paper on natural streams and the legacy of water-powered mills. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. This month, Science's STKE changed its name to Science Signaling, one of the many changes coming to this online journal devoted to signal transduction, the set of biochemical processes by which cells respond to their environment and communicate with each other. We're also pleased to announce the debut of the Science Signaling podcast. In the first show, editors Elizabeth Adler and Nancy Gaugh discuss new research on how the brain changes to cope with an eye that does not see well during an early period of development, and how that leads to amblyopia, or what is commonly called lazy eye. Here's an excerpt.
Many aspects of brain function are modulated by experience, with experience leading to neuronal activity. And in some cases, these effects of neuronal activity are restricted to a particular developmental stage that's called a critical period. So it turns out that if there's a temporary loss of vision from one eye during a critical period early in development, that eye ends up never functioning as well as the other eye, even if it's structurally perfect.
So Liz, it sounds like even if your vision is subsequently corrected with glasses or through surgery or something, you may never see as well out of that eye that wasn't working during that critical period.
That's true. So for instance, if babies are born with a cataract and it isn't corrected until after the critical period, even once that cataract is corrected, they never are able to see as well through that eye as they can through the other one. Whereas with an adult, if you develop a cataract at some point way beyond the critical period, even if you have the cataract for several years, once it's removed, you can see with that eye again. So the researchers in this paper were investigating the role of polysialic acid in this process of ocular dominance plasticity.
That was an excerpt from the new Science Signaling podcast with Elizabeth Adler and Nancy Gaugh talking about polysialic acid's role in ocular dominance plasticity, the cause of amblyopia, or lazy eye. If you would like to hear more, click over to the Science Signaling website, stke.sciencemag.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Rob, I've got three cool stories for you. We'll talk about why high prices make you feel good, how to make a submarine disappear, and finally, we'll talk about a cosmic cloud that's on a collision course with the Milky Way.
Well, before we discuss the possibility of the end of the world as we know it, high prices make you feel good? That doesn't sound like good marketing to me.
Well, in fact, it's actually very good marketing. And the reason is if you've ever noticed that if you are comparing two products, say two bottles of wine, and maybe one bottle is $10 and one bottle is $50, if you drank both of them, chances are you'd think the $50 bottle of wine tastes a lot better, even if there was no difference in quality. So researchers wanted to figure out, is there actually anything physiological to this effect of thinking that higher prices make things better, at least make things taste better. So researchers stuck with the wine example. And what they did is they gave 20 volunteers what they said were five different types of Cabernet Sauvignon wine. And in reality, they were only giving them three different kinds. They had a $5 bottle of wine, they had a $35 bottle of wine, and a $90 bottle of wine. And what they did was the $5 bottle of wine was also labeled with a sticker that said $5 and a sticker that said $45, and the $90 bottle of wine was labeled with a $90 sticker, but also a $10 sticker. And they had the subjects taste all these wines, and they saw the prices of all the wines. And sure enough, even when the subjects tasted the $5 bottle of wine, if it was marked as a $45 bottle of wine, they thought it tasted a lot better than when the same exact wine was marked as a $5 bottle of wine. So that confirms anecdotal evidence that when something is marked with a higher price, we think it tastes better.
So what did the researchers look at in looking inside the brain?
Well, during the taste testing, the researchers had the subjects in an fMRI machine, which measures blood flow to various parts of the brain, and therefore it can tell you what parts of the brain are more active during certain activities. And what the researchers found is when the subjects were tasting the wines that were marked as more expensive, there was more activity in a part of their brain known as the medial orbitofrontal cortex. And this part of the brain is responsible for judging the pleasantness of experiences. So what the researchers think what's happening is when you expect something to be better, i.e. when it's marked with a higher price, these pleasure centers of your brain are more active, and therefore you're experiencing what you think are more expensive products as tasting better.
Sort of a kind of placebo effect then, isn't it?
Right. It's kind of like the placebo effect where even though you're getting something that shouldn't be having this effect on you, it does because of your brain's expectations.
So a good tip for people hosting a party would be to substitute all their cheap wine labels with more expensive ones.
Exactly. I'm planning on doing that at my next event.
I'll be there. Well, from making cheap wine labels disappear to how to make a submarine disappear. Does that mean disappearing acoustically?
Exactly. And to understand the study, you need to understand a little bit about how sonar works. And sonar works basically by emitting sound waves that when they hit an object, say a submarine, they bounce back off that object, back into the sonar detector, and that's how we know something's there. So if you want to make something invisible to sonar, all you have to do is make sure the sound waves don't bounce off the object. But that's a lot easier said than done.
So what went into this sound cloaking device?
Well, this is more a thought experiment. The researchers didn't actually design anything, but what they were wondering is it even possible to do this so-called acoustic cloaking? And what they did is they ran a bunch of calculations and computer simulations to see if an object could be created that wouldn't reflect sound waves when sound waves hit it. And they found that indeed it is possible to create such materials. They're not naturally occurring. They would have to be man-made and would be very difficult to make them. But this is the first time it's been shown that such materials could actually be produced.
So beyond not being able to detect a submarine, where else might you use this technology, should it ever be invented?
Well, the researchers say there's a lot of potential applications beyond just making a submarine disappear, or at least appear like it's disappeared. You could use it to reduce turbulence on airplanes, resulting in smoother flights, and even make auditoriums quieter and have less reverb. So there's a lot of potential applications of this technology, should it ever be invented. But now at least we've got the computer simulations that show us that it's possible, assuming somebody can produce the required materials.
Well, from trying to make an object disappear to the appearance of cosmic clouds, why hadn't scientists detected these clouds, which appear to be coming straight for us?
Well, that's a good question, Rob. And the reason is because these clouds are accumulations of neutral hydrogen gas, which optical telescopes can't pick up. So it wasn't until about 50 years ago with the advent of radio telescopes that astronomers first started spotting these clouds. And there's many of them outside the Milky Way galaxy. But they didn't know a lot about them. So a team of astronomers focused on one of these clouds, which is called Smith's Cloud. And that was discovered by a Dutch astronomy student named Gale Smith in 1963. And they were curious about this cloud in particular because it seemed to have an unusual shape. So they took 40,000 radio measurements of this cloud. They really spent a lot of time on it to figure out where it was going, what it looked like, did it pose a threat. And what they found is the cloud actually does have a pretty unusual shape. It's shaped like a comet, which they think is due to the tidal effects of the Milky Way. But even more important, they found that this cloud, which is about 8,000 light years away, is indeed heading for us at about 250 kilometers per second.
So it's going to be quite a long time before we see this hitting the Milky Way, right?
Well, a long time in human terms, but not so long in astronomical terms. It's going to take about 40 million years for it to get here, so you and I won't be around when it gets here. But when it does get here, it's going to put on a pretty spectacular show. It's going to smash into the interstellar gas in the Milky Way. And when it does that, the cloud's going to condense into thousands or even millions of stars. So it's going to be a pretty spectacular event. And there's going to be a whole new mess of stars added to the Milky Way galaxy.
Is that the end of the world as we know it?
Well, not our world, at least. Even though the cloud is going to hit the Milky Way, it's actually going to happen very far away from where we are. So we shouldn't feel any effects from it. But any humans around 40 million years from now are going to see a pretty spectacular light show.
As long as they've got their telescopes trained in the right part of the sky.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about why ground squirrels rub themselves with snake skin, a new genus of a self-destructive palm found in Madagascar, and finally, how people make snap judgments about other people's sexual orientation. So make sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the January 18th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any questions or comments for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is the production of Science Magazine and AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.